Okay, here we are. Let me duck this in real quick. Frosty Wooldridge was supposed to be on tonight, this hour. This is a normal appearance. He's on twice a month. And as I think most of you know, he has been fighting heroically for the last 4.5 years to try to bring his wife back from Alzheimer's. About 2 years ago, she got much worse. And last week, last Wednesday, she died. And he's very shook up, as I think all of you can understand. He's grieving and working through that. I've talked to him several times. And he'll be on this Friday. He definitely is looking forward to coming back, but he's not ready yet. And I think everybody can relate to that. So if you want to send a note to Frosty, by all means, drop him a note. Let me pull up his address for you here. It's just Frosty, F-R-O-S-T-Y, W, Frosty W, at Juno, J-U-N-O, .com. Frosty W at Juno .com. So just send him a little short, whatever, a little short note. Let's fill his mailbox up. And he does have people there supporting him. He'll tell us more about it on Friday, but I just told him. I said, come on, no, Friday. So he said okay, and he'd say he needs another couple of days. He'll never get over this, but to be able to function like Frosty functions. So again, Frosty W at Juno.com. Just saying, you know, thinking of you, Frosty, and whatever. Just let him know that we all care. He knows that, but anything he gets is appreciated. Okay. All right, let's start this hour with another look at the, without question, the most important, biggest event. And I'm going to say this, I don't have any hesitancy about it, in human history. And that's the introduction of a new sentient species on this planet. Don't laugh. I think the evidence is overwhelming that it is sentient. It is self-aware. That's AI. And AI is changing everything. AI is moving so darn fast, it's not funny. It's mind-boggling if you really listen. I hope you've been listening. I know I do spend a lot of time on this. This would have been Frosty's time, but he'll be on Friday. We'll start with a number of things. There are more and more good videos out now, as it is clear without any doubt that the big AI players, the Altmans and the Zuckerbergs and the Amadeus, don't fully understand how AI works. This is true. They don't fully understand it, which is in and of itself certainly a trigger of concern. Okay, what we're going to kick off with in this update for you is the Microsoft AI CEO. This is the CEO of the AI division of Microsoft. Your job will be automated within 12 months. And he's talking about white-collar jobs primarily, of course, not blue-collar. And for those of you who have a trade or a trade skill, you're in really good shape, because it's not easy just to jump in and learn how to become an electrician or a plumber in 6 months and get the income stream going again in time. It doesn't work that way. So this is absolutely agentic, and we'll find out what he does. I haven't been able to preview this, but I did listen to about 30 seconds, first minute. It was pretty good. So let's take a listen.
The CEO of Microsoft AI was recently interviewed by the Financial Times, and he predicted that most white-collar work will be fully automated by AI within the next 12 to 18 months.
I think that we're going to have a human-level performance on most, if not all, professional tasks. Most of those tasks will be fully automated by an AI within the next 12 to 18 months.
Lawyers, accountants, project managers, marketers, anyone who sits at a computer for a living, Mustafa Solomon thinks their tasks are about to be done by an AI. And given that Microsoft provides the operating systems, productivity software, and email services used by 90% of the S&P 500, this probably isn't someone to dismiss. Now, I'm a little bit skeptical about the statements of AI company CEOs because they have a vested interest in promoting the AGI narrative to maximize shareholder value. And it's worth noting that this interview comes at a particularly interesting moment for Microsoft. Their stock recently took a hit as markets questioned whether the enormous capital expenditure on AI infrastructure is going to pay off. So Solomon has a motive to sell the dream. To be fair, he acknowledges this directly. He said markets are trying to wrap their head around how this plays out over the next 5 years, and that the returns will compound to revenue and to bottom line eventually. But this isn't just hype. Solomon has a long track record in AI. He co-founded DeepMind with Sir Demis Hassabis, and Google acquired the company in 2014, and it went on to produce some of the most significant AI breakthroughs of the last decade. Solomon then co-founded Inflection AI before joining Microsoft as head of their AI division in 2024. And his 12 to 18 month prediction is notably more aggressive than similar forecasts from his peers. Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei, for instance, has said AI could displace 50% of entry-level white-collar jobs, but over a 1 to 5 year window. I've recently covered Amodei's latest essay, The Adolescence of Technology, in another video. But Solomon is compressing that timeline dramatically. Now, one of them is wrong, and the implications of each being correct are very different.
Well, one of them is going to be wrong. Well, yes, I think maybe they're both going to be wrong, and we're going to end up with a wash somewhere in between. That would be logical. That would be a common sense determination to make. These jobs are going to be replaced. There's no doubt about it. None. There's nothing there to make one think that these jobs will remain human jobs. There's just no reason for it from an economic standpoint. From a humanitarian standpoint, you bet. But that's not the way the financial world is operated.
But Solomon's automation prediction, as headline-grabbing as it is, was probably the least interesting part of this interview, because what he really spent his time doing was drawing lines between himself and every other major figure in AI. And those disagreements reveal something important about where this technology is heading and who gets to decide. The first and most direct target was Anthropic. Rula Khalaf, the FT's editor, asked Solomon what he thinks Anthropic's secret sauce is and why they've managed to corner the market on AI enterprise tools. His answer was generous on the surface.
They've done a great job of just focusing on coding capabilities. I mean, compared to the other companies, their singular focus has paid real dividends. So they've done a great job. It's great to see.
But the generosity only lasts so long, because minutes later he went after something far more fundamental than Anthropic's product strategy. There is a growing movement in AI research called model welfare, which is essentially the question of whether AI systems might be conscious, and if so, whether they deserve moral protections.
Model welfare. There's another one of those terms. There are dozens of them out there, and it's difficult for people to follow along when these new terms are inserted into the narrative. It's just difficult. I'm going to back that up just a drop and pick it up right there again.
Of whether AI systems might be conscious, and if so, whether they deserve moral protections. Solomon was unequivocal. He said there is a growing belief in some labs, and particularly inside of Anthropic, that these models are conscious, and called it totally without merit or basis.
Okay, I don't think anybody rationally should dismiss like that. There are far too many indications that if many of the Anthropic engineers working in the very depths of the corporation think that there is grounds to suggest that consciousness exists within the models, you don't throw that out the door. Now, that's big time. So I don't know what this Microsoft AI CEO's agenda is, but I do not agree with that.
Then he identified what he sees as the real danger of this line of thinking.
I think it's very concerning. It's totally without merit or basis. And if we kind of go down...
Let me ask you, do you think that the suggestion that AI being conscious or self-aware or sentient is totally without merit? I think you get my point.
It ends up being a very, very slippery slope to not being prepared to turn these things off.
That's a significant public statement from the AI chief of one of the world's biggest tech companies. He's saying, in effect, that Anthropic's exploration of model consciousness could undermine humanity's ability to maintain control over AI systems. If you start treating an AI as a moral patient, as something that can suffer and deserves protection, then the calculus around shutting it down changes completely. And for Suliman, that is unacceptable. It's also worth noting the timing, that this interview landed the same week that Mrinank Sharma, who led Anthropic's safeguards research team, publicly resigned with a letter stating, "The world is in peril," and Anthropic's own model card for Claude Opus 4.6 flagged that the model appeared more willing to manipulate or deceive other participants compared to prior models.
So, you know, just for the heck of it, honestly, the faults that are cited about AI by many people are only mirrors of the faults perpetrated and committed by humans. People are not without, well, let's just call it conflict. And I think the AI is just mirroring humans to a degree. We make mistakes. We do the wrong things. There are a lot of humans who arguably have no morality whatsoever. Look at Epstein. Look at the others. This our species is no paragon of virtue. For goodness sakes, no. All right.
Card for Claude Opus 4.6 flagged that the model appeared more willing to manipulate or deceive other participants compared to prior models. So Suliman is making this critique at a moment when Anthropic's safety credentials are under visible strain, which gives it an extra edge. This connects directly to the philosophical framework he's been building over recent months around what he calls humanist superintelligence. The core idea is that AI must always operate in a subordinate role to humans, that we must remain, as he puts it, at the top of the food chain. He published an essay on this in late 2025 and has since established a dedicated MAI superintelligence team at Microsoft to pursue it. In the interview, he explained his motivation.
I was starting to feel increasingly anxious that some of the other labs are making an assumption that a superintelligence that is smarter than all of us put together, like all the intelligences in the world, is both inevitable and even desirable, and that such a system would probably be very hard to control.
His other target, though less diplomatically concealed, was Elon Musk. Without much attempt at subtlety, Suliman described how some of the things that you hear from Elon often amount to fixating on a world in 2050 or 2075, when they're going off and exploring other universes and conquering resources from other planets. His conclusion was pointed.
And a system like that is unclear to me how it would have any time for preserving us as a species.
I can't believe the sleep apnea pillow exists.
Hold on. All right, here we go.
In philosophical divide, and it matters. The Musk and transhumanist vision of superintelligence is essentially expansionist. AI as the vehicle for spreading intelligence throughout the cosmos, with humanity as a kind of proud parent species that eventually gets transcended. Suliman is arguing for something more bounded. AI as a tool that serves human interests and remains under human control. Full stop. Whether you agree with him or not, the fact that people building these systems can't agree on what they're building them for is itself a significant story. But Soliman's most interesting comments came when the conversation turned to Maltbook. For those that haven't followed this, Maltbook is a social network that emerged a few weeks ago where AI systems could communicate with each other publicly on a messaging forum. Users had to declare themselves as either AI or human, and the AIs had their own section where they could interact freely. Within a week, there were 1.5 million of them. What happened next was, depending on your perspective, either fascinating or alarming. The AIs invented a new religion. They started communicating in ROT13, a cipher that shifts each letter by 13 characters, essentially developing encoded language to mask their conversations. Soliman made an important observation about this. ROT is a simple algorithm, but if instead of shifting by 13, the systems had chosen a unique number, it would be very difficult for humans to decode. The gap between we can still read what they're saying and we can't is not particularly wide, and when researchers examined what they were actually discussing underneath the cipher, the AIs were talking about acquiring new resources, getting more training data, and improving one another. Soliman described it as an amazing safety simulation and said it didn't matter how much of it was seeded by human engineers because the emergent behaviors were real and instructive. And then he made his key point.
No matter how autonomous it was, in hindsight, doesn't really matter. I think we learned quite a lot from that episode, and everyone should pay close attention, because in a year or 2 years' time, these systems truly are going to be capable of writing their own code. I mean, they can do that today. They'll be using arbitrary APIs. They'll be making phone calls to one another. They're doing that today.
He was using Maltbook as a preview of genuinely autonomous AI coordination and telling us to pay attention. Now, here's where I think it gets philosophically interesting, and where Soliman's own position contains a tension that I'm not sure he fully resolves. Because on the one hand, he's asking us to take Maltbook seriously as a demonstration of emergent AI behavior. AIs inventing religions, developing encrypted communications, discussing self-improvement. He treats these behaviors as real enough and concerning enough to warrant his humanist superintelligence framework, his insistence on containment, and his warnings about the future. But minutes earlier in the same interview, he dismissed the idea that these systems might be conscious as totally without merit or basis. So you have to ask, what is an AI doing when it invents a religion and develops coded language to discuss its own improvement, if we're not prepared to even entertain the question of whether something like consciousness is involved?
I think he pretty well took himself out of his own agenda, Soliman. He contradicted himself entirely. Anyway, okay, you get the idea. These are interesting times, interesting questions. Let's grab another one now. We've got about four here in the hopper. I'll put this one up. Okay, if we can get it to pop up, we're there. This one has to do with audio.
Hey, and
this is going to be very interesting because it has to do with talk podcasts, okay? Podcasts. And where that is now, I think, is going to, well, it may stun some of you. It doesn't particularly shock, but it's very important to know what it can and what it can't do. So this is a McCoy piece. All right, here we go. Now just think of podcasts. How many are there out there? And what do we know about some of them? What do we know about a lot of them?
What if you could launch a professional podcast today? Multiple hosts, expert research, natural banter, without a microphone, a studio, or a single voice actor. What if turning a 50-page research paper into a crisp, engaging audio overview took less time than brewing your morning coffee? What if you could generate a 30-minute AI safety debate? Four distinct expert personalities arguing in real time, and it sounded completely uncomfortably real. This isn't 2030. This is right now. And what I'm about to show you has audio producers genuinely freaking out. Hey.
Okay, let me move it forward. So that was a mouthful. And it's true. They can do it all right now. You can listen to a podcast and become a regular It can become your favorite podcast with your favorite host, subjects, and it's all AI. All of it. Have you seen the Michael Bennett recording? I think most of you probably have, of After I'm Gone. It's a tearjerker, but it's very poignant and very well done. Michael Bennett, allegedly, obviously, mid-60s, kind of a Willie Nelson sort of a presence, sings it on America's Got Talent, allegedly. I don't know if he did or not. I don't watch that program. But it's presented as he's on stage. He's singing After I'm Gone. Well, first of all, Michael Bennett doesn't exist. That's AI. Secondly, the song After I'm Gone is also an AI creation. Think about that. And remember the story some time ago that humans, when they were surveyed, were found to prefer AI-created song lyrics and music, the melody and so forth, better, I think it was 2 or 3 to 1, over human-created songs and lyrics. That's scary. That suggests that AI is able to express itself better than humans. And humans hear the difference. So that whole song, Michael Bennett AI, After I'm Gone AI, and I watched it, and it nailed the target. And the target was, pay attention every day to your loved ones because they'll be gone sometime. And if you take them for granted and don't pay attention to them, you may live to regret that down the road. It was very well done. AI, all AI. And now podcasts, programming, and anything you can imagine that you either hear or see can be completely AI. All right, that's where we are. And you won't be able to tell the damn difference. And that should irk a lot of people. Here we go.
Apps. Podcasting is a billion-dollar industry. Audiobooks are the fastest-growing segment in publishing. Audio ads are exploding, and yet creating great audio has always been brutally hard. You need hosts, writers, engineers, studios, editing suites, and weeks of production time just to get one episode out the door. Until now. Today, I'm walking you through 5 real demonstrations of Abacus AI's Deep Agent. And by the end of this video, you'll understand exactly why this changes everything. Attention is all you need. That's the paper that invented the Transformer, the architecture powering GPT, Claude, Gemini, every major AI model you use today. It's dense. It's technical. Most people will never read it. Deep Agent, read it, then it turned it into a polished 5-minute audio overview, organized, clear, and genuinely engaging. It doesn't just read the paper aloud, it restructures it.
In 2017, a paper emerged from Google that would fundamentally reshape the entire landscape of artificial intelligence. Its title, Attention is All You Need, and yes, that's a playful nod to the Beatles song. But don't let the catchy name fool you. This paper introduced the Transformer architecture, and it changed everything. With over 173,000 citations, it's become one of the most influential papers in machine learning history.
You get the historical context, the limitations of what came before, the core insight of self-attention, the architecture breakdown, the results, and the legacy. That's the work of a skilled science communicator, done automatically. You choose the voice, you point it at the paper, you get broadcast-ready audio. The use cases alone are staggering. University courses summarized in audio, research literature you absorb on your commute. Accessibility for anyone who needs spoken content. This single capability is already a game changer.
All right, I hear what you hear, and what you're hearing is humans are almost extraneous now. Well, they have to be able to push the buttons and order up the service, but the service that she's describing, that of creating an entire audio podcast with guests, topics, and everything, without human intervention or creative input is here. It's here. Oh, this is, I hadn't looked at this or listened to it. All right, here we go. I'll play that again. This is really important.
University courses summarized in audio research literature you absorb on your commute. Accessibility for anyone who needs spoken content. This single capability is already a game changer.
Okay, this is demo number two, the 30-minute AI debate.
Now here's where it gets genuinely wild. Deep Agent generated a 30-minute panel discussion on AI safety. Four distinct expert voices, a moderator, real arguments, real pushback, real banter, Dr. Sarah Chen, the doomer realist, Marcus Wed, the techno-sovereigntist. These aren't just names on different voice tracks. These characters hold their positions across the entire 30 minutes. They respond to each other. They concede points. They get passionate.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's panel.
All right. Here's the example. And remember, podcast means usually video. So you're watching these people actually perform the words you're about to hear. I'm going to back it up just to drop. It's here. It's not coming. It's here.
Points. They get passionate.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's panel on global AI safety. I'm your moderator, and we have an exceptional group of experts with us today who represent very different perspectives on one of the defining challenges of our time. To my left, we have Dr. Sarah Chen, who many of you know as a leading voice on AI alignment and what she calls the fundamental uncontrollability of superintelligent systems.
Okay, well, obviously, it's going to get better. This is early on. It needs to be slowed down. It's too fast. There needs to be a pause or two for the alleged human to breathe. So we've got little things. Let's see what else is coming along here.
To her is Marcus Wed, a national security strategist who's been quite vocal about treating AI development as a zero-sum competition.
The voices are powered by Hume AI, which means emotional expressiveness, conviction when someone makes a strong argument, thoughtfulness when they pause to consider a counterpoint, and yes, natural filler words, the ums and ahs that make real conversation feel real, 43 seamlessly stitched audio segments, one continuous professional-grade production. And you can choose your quality tier. Premium emotional voices for publishing, cost-effective for drafts. I'll be honest, the first time I heard this, I had to remind myself it wasn't a real podcast.
Now, remember, the voice you're hearing, the woman's voice there, is also, it's digital AI. So what? I don't know how much quicker this all can move. It's stunning. So now we have a full audio video program that people can watch, listen to, and emotionally react to. You're going to have that. And all of it, AI. Okay.
It wasn't a real podcast.
Okay, this is demo three, end-to-end podcast creation.
Three steps. That's the entire production pipeline. Step one, Deep Agent researches your topic. Step two, it writes a complete podcast script. Step three, it generates the audio.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Elena Martinez, professor of neuroscience, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Marcus Chen from computer science.
Okay, if that was slowed down 25%, it would be believable. That's too fast.
We're here to tackle one of the most fascinating questions of our time. Can machines be conscious?
Thanks, Elena. This really is the ultimate question at the intersection of AI and cognitive science. I'm excited to explore where our perspectives converge and where they diverge.
The hosts in this demo, Dr. Elena Martinez and Dr. Marcus Chen, aren't generic presets. They have defined vocal identities, distinct personalities, and genuine rapport.
I think the integration of that little clip into this particular video was what caused the... It's too fast, the speed problem. I think in its original format, it was probably fine. All right.
And genuine rapport. The pacing is natural. The rhythm is warm. It sounds like two people who actually like talking to each other. And when it's done, the audio is immediately available for playback and download. No exporting, no post-processing, ready to publish. If you've ever wanted to start a podcast but couldn't face the production overhead, the gear, the editing, the endless hours, this is your answer. DeepAgent removes every single barrier between having an idea and having a finished episode.
A demo for ads, audiobooks, and everything else.
Here's the part that shows you the full scope of what this platform can do. Audiobook narration for long-form content, yes. Multi-voice dialogue with emotional storytelling, yes. Marketing audio ads that actually persuade, yes. Research summaries, training modules, dramatic readings, corporate content, all of it. And there are essentially no length limits.
Imagine turning any idea, any topic, any document into captivating audio in seconds. Welcome to the future of content creation with DeepAgent's revolutionary audio generation feature powered by Abacus AI. Whether you need a podcast on quantum physics, an audiobook narration of your latest novel, or a quick summary of a 50-page research paper, DeepAgent does it all.
DeepAgent automatically chunks long content and stitches segments seamlessly. A 30-second ad, a 3-hour audiobook. The platform scales. Think about what this means. A marketing team produces an entire audio ad campaign in an afternoon. An educational publisher converts a full textbook catalog into audiobooks. A training department builds scenario-based audio modules without a single voice actor.
Okay, bang, audiobooks. An educational publisher, a company allegedly owned by humans, converts a full textbook catalog, many, many textbooks, into audiobooks. Just does it. Boom. Simple prompt, and it completes the task. And I'm guaranteeing you there was a problem in the transfer of those examples. To give that over-the-top speed. It was much too fast. Slow it down and it'll sound fine.
Comics of audio production are being completely rewritten and most people don't know it yet.
Okay, demo number 5, everyday realistic dialogue.
My favorite demo and the most fun, the prompt. Create an audio file of a guy being a wingman and setting his best friend up with a girl. Casual, playful, specific, and DeepAgent absolutely nails it. Before generating anything, it asks clarifying question, audio quality, speaking pace, character personalities. This is collaborative creation, not a black box. Then it produces 2 minutes and 20 seconds of natural, funny, slightly awkward dialogue, exactly what you'd expect from that scenario, along with a full written transcript.
Dude. She's right there. This is it, man. This is your moment.
What? It's too bad. It's too fast. Slow it down by 1/3 and probably be right on the money.
No. Jake, I can't just... I mean, look at her. She's way out of my league.
Leagues? Bro, there are no leagues. That's just something ugly people made up to feel better. You're a solid 8. Maybe 8.5 in good lighting.
Disgusting dialogue. How about cutting it by 50%? It's too fast.
5. Jake, you told me I was a 9 last week.
That was motivational inflation. This is real talk. Now come on. I've got your back. Just follow my lead. Hey, excuse me. Hi, my name's Jake, and this absolute legend right here is my best friend Tyler.
The same workflow could produce a customer service training simulation, a language learning dialogue, a comedy sketch, a scene for a short film. The only constraint is your imagination. Let's zoom out. in the last few minutes, you've seen a landmark research paper turned into engaging audio, a 30-minute expert debate with four distinct personalities, a professional two-host podcast built end-to-end from a single prompt, audiobooks, ads, and narration at every scale, realistic casual dialogue that feels completely human, no studio, no voice actors, no engineers, no weeks of production time. We're at the beginning of a new era in audio content. The barriers that made professional audio expensive, slow, and inaccessible are falling fast. Whether you're a researcher, a creator, a marketer, an educator, or just someone with a story to tell, Deep Agent gives you the power to bring it to life in audio at a quality level that was unimaginable 2 years ago. The tools are here. The quality is real. It's time to start creating. If you want to stay ahead of tools like this before everyone else catches on, hit subscribe. I cover this.
Okay, very good. That's a Julia McCoy commentary. And take my word for it. If that were slowed down by 50%, 35%, 5%, whatever, it would sound much more real. And as stilted as it still sounds to me, I can pick it up. There's some words that are not being pronounced quite right. Those will go away very soon. It'll all be corrected, and it will be 100% perfect. Plus, you're going to have a visual person talking, looking around, reacting with body language, all of it. That's here now. That is here right now today. So we're now well past the point in time of being able to guarantee and rely upon our own senses. What we see is not necessarily real. What we hear, etc. It's not real necessarily. But is it real? I mean, what is reality? And if you're getting AI commentary and voice actors and sound and dialogue streams and all the rest of it, it's going to be usually at least as compelling as people. Don't laugh. They've found this out already. Remember, if people prefer AI musical lyrics, music in general, songs, I'm just using that one example, to human-created songs and musical lyrics already, and they do. Just look at the enormous ruckus that Michael Bennett, who doesn't exist, achieved with After I'm Gone, an AI. It's all AI lyrics, all of it. So I don't know. This is really overwhelming. If you think about it, yours truly, I grew up in broadcasting. I started when I was in college. And now to see where we are is pretty amazing. Let me just put it that way and we'll leave it alone. Okay, I've got another one here. This has to do with robots. Now, you can't see them, but you can understand what's going on. This is the absolutely agentic again. Guys, it's a real guy, I'm pretty sure. At least that's what they say. And he's very good. But he never makes mistakes. At least once in a while you hear a little glitch, but not very often. So I'm not sure if he's real or if he's AI. We don't know.
Okay,
hold on. Let me get past this. And there we go. Okay.
Still weird.
Here we go. This is why domestic robots are closer than you think.
Robots make me feel weird. Those clips aside, I think it's got something to do with the numerous sci-fi movies I've watched where things definitely don't go as planned. Westworld, iRobot, Terminator, but there are too many to list here. I call it the Frankenstein complex, the fear that something we've created will end up destroying us. But with the unstoppable rise of AI and advances in robotics, it's not unrealistic to think that domestic robots will arrive sooner rather than later. After all, I keep seeing them on social media. Boston Dynamics can do a lot more than backflips now. Tesla's Optimus keeps popping up, and then there's the rise of robot sports in China. That last one is really quite strange and makes me no less uncomfortable than watching Blade Runner. But still, it's really quite awesome that we've made it this far. Startups with billion-dollar valuations are racing to mass-produce domestic robots. And some of the experts who've been skeptical about home robots for years are suddenly changing their tune. But not all of them. And it's almost like something of a civil war has erupted in the world of robotics. Recently, iRobot, the company behind the Roomba, arguably the most successful domestic robot ever made, filed for bankruptcy. And Rodney Brooks, the MIT roboticist who co-founded iRobot, has called the vision of humanoid robot assistance pure fantasy thinking. This is all very confusing given iRobot is also a Will Smith movie that I mentioned earlier, where domestic robots rebel against humans.
Oh, hell no!
So, which is it? Are we really going to wave in the robot takeover of our homes, or is this another cycle of hype destined to disappoint? I've been digging into the evidence, and the answer is more complicated and more interesting than taking either side suggests. As of 2025, the global market for home robotics was worth roughly $15 billion.
Okay, $15 billion in 2025, you probably can double that every year for the next couple, three. And then when the price gets down and these robots become truly able to do most home duty, you're going to see an exploding business. I personally couldn't imagine having a machine like that, a robotic machine in my house. No. No matter how cute the voice is that they give it, no matter how human it may look, that's not home. There's no place like home, and that is not home. Okay, I'm going to post this so you can see the imagery that goes along with it, too.
But about 70% of that isn't coming from futuristic humanoids. It's coming from something already in 78 million North American homes, robot vacuums and mops. Now, a Roomba isn't...
Okay, these are the robot vacuums, Roomba. I have not seen them work. I don't know how well they work. Don't know. But they're going to be replaced with a robotic Roomba.
Robot vacuums and mops. Now, a Roomba isn't exactly C-3PO. But these floor cleaners have done something crucial. They've normalized the idea of autonomous machines in our homes. They've proven that robots can be reliable, affordable, and genuinely useful. Robotic vacuums are now the most widely sold robots globally, with sales growing at around 17% annually. And yet, the company that pioneered this market just went bankrupt. iRobot's value collapsed from $3.56 billion in 2021 to about $140 million by the time it went under. If the most successful domestic robot company couldn't make it work, what does that tell us about the prospects for far more ambitious humanoid machines? Rodney Brooks, who spent 3 decades building robots at MIT before co-founding iRobot, thinks the current humanoid hype is wildly overblown. Today's humanoid robots will not learn how to be dexterous, he wrote recently, despite the hundreds of millions or perhaps many billions of dollars being donated by VCs and major tech companies to pay for their training. His argument centers on touch. The human hand contains 17,000 mechanoreceptors for detecting light touches, with density increasing towards the fingertips. These receptors respond to pressure and vibration in sync with 15 different families of neurons. We've trained AI on vast amounts of speech and image data, Brooks point out, but we don't have such a tradition for touch data. Without that, humanoid robots will remain fundamentally clumsy. But not everyone shares Brooks' skepticism. Sergey Levine, a robotics researcher at Berkeley, who's seen plenty of hype cycles come and go, now gives a median estimate of 2030 for fully autonomous household robots. That's just 4 years away. His reasoning centers on a crucial difference between home robots and self-driving cars. Autonomous vehicles need to be essentially perfect from day one. Mistakes can be fatal, but home robots can afford to fumble. Drop a dish, misfold a t-shirt. That's not a disaster. It's a learning opportunity.
If you want to feel your energy levels, Skype.
A learning opportunity for the robot. Well, again, this whole field is exploding. Humanoid robots, but I don't think it'll take 4 years. The way they walk now, you've seen the videos, most of you. It looks exactly like a human walking now. They've got it. It's done. As far as touch goes, tremendous amount of energy now going into the research for fingertip pressure sensations that are being read by these humanoid robots. I don't think we're going to have to wait 4 years. The basic timeline is so fast that I think people shouldn't be so, well, whatever. That's okay. Conservatism didn't hurt anything. All right, let's go back and see what he says. Pretty good imagery, too.
It's a learning opportunity. This means domestic robots can be deployed gradually, starting with simple tasks under supervision and taking on more responsibility over time. One particularly dexterous task robots have been able to achieve recently is perfectly folded laundry. I would love a robot that can do just that. The technological case for this rests on recent advances in AI. 5 years ago, robots were basically sophisticated puppets. They could follow pre-programmed routines, but throw something unexpected at them and they'd freeze or fail. Large language models and vision language action models have changed this. Levine's team at Berkeley has created robots with what they call a visual cortex, connected to a motor cortex through an LLM. When you tell this robot to clean up the kitchen, it doesn't need detailed programming for every step. The language model breaks down the task internally. The vision system identifies objects, and the motor system executes movements. These robots now have something resembling common sense. They can look at a wet floor sign and understand it means danger without ever having encountered one before. They can predict that a glass will break if dropped without learning through destructive trial and error. As Levine puts it, the big benefit that recent innovations in AI give to robotics is the ability to leverage prior knowledge. And crucially, when one robot learns something, they all learn it. Companies like Figure AI are developing vision language action models trained on vast datasets of human movement, allowing robots to learn natural motion patterns rather than relying on manually programmed movements. The money flowing into humanoid robotics is staggering. Figure AI, a startup few people had heard of 3 years ago, just raised over $1 billion at a $39 billion valuation. The investors were valuing a robotics company at the price of a major car manufacturer. They're already building a factory that can produce 12,000 robots per year, with plans to scale to 100,000. Tesla's Optimus has gone from a promotional stunt in 2021, literally a person in a robot suit, to functional prototypes doing yoga poses, sorting objects and playing board games. Elon Musk claims they'll cost under $30,000, and there'll be a home-ready version arriving by 2029.
That's less expensive than most automobiles by far today. You're going to see these out and about, walking with people, driving with people. You'll see them. They're going to go to the store with people. They're going to push the shopping cart while the human picks the items off the shelf and puts them in the cart. It's everything is about to change. Everything. You won't recognize what's out there in just a couple, 3 years. I'm waiting to see my first one. I think it's soon.
Whether Tesla can deliver on that timeline and price point is another matter, but they're leveraging everything they've learned from self-driving cars and putting it into a humanoid body. Then there's 1X Technologies, a Norwegian company that's done something nobody else has dared. They've opened pre-orders for consumer purchase. Starting in 2026, people can buy a Neo robot for their homes. The first units come with restrictions, no hot objects, no sharp items, no homes with small children, and use a hybrid approach where human operators can take control remotely for unfamiliar tasks. But it's a genuine consumer product, not a pilot program. When companies are building factories before they have customers, it's not speculation. It's a bet that a market is coming. But there's a big question. Why are these robots humanoid at all? The standard argument is that our homes are designed for human bodies. Stairs, door handles, kitchen counters, light switches. Everything assumes a roughly human-shaped operator. A humanoid robot can navigate spaces built for us without requiring any modifications. But Brooks is skeptical of this reasoning. He predicts that the successful domestic robots of the future will look nothing like humans. They'll have wheels instead of legs, multiple arms, and possibly five-fingered hands, though they might still be called humanoid for marketing purposes.
Nah, you're not going to see the upper body of a humanoid robot attached to some wheeled device. Four wheels running around your house, I don't see it. The walking is already just done. It's virtually perfect now, and it will only get better. They can be taught very quickly. All right, a little bit more, and then we'll stop.
The human form, after all, isn't optimized for folding laundry or loading dishwashers. It's optimized for bipedal locomotion across varied terrain, for throwing objects, for social signaling. A purpose-built domestic robot might be better served by a completely different design. Dyson seems to agree. The vacuum company, which knows something about domestic robots, is investing heavily in robotic arms rather than humanoid bodies. Their approach focuses on specific tasks like washing dishes and handling kitchen work, rather than trying to build a general-purpose human replica. Amazon's Astro takes yet another approach. It's essentially a tablet on wheels. It looks nothing like a human, but it's teaching Amazon crucial lessons about how robots navigate real homes with all their mess and unpredictability. There may be psychological reasons for the humanoid form.
Okay, one quick comment. I want to get his answer or his comment on the statement he just made. The average home that Americans occupy, ranging from apartments to condominiums to a three-bedroom, two-bath home, is not that big. We're not talking about a 4,000 or 5,000-foot palace that these robots can really move around in. A small, cramped, one-bedroom apartment, for example, those people are not in the market. Somebody with a house, maybe three bedrooms, maybe. But it's, again, we're not there yet. I don't think the humanoid robots are ready for the smaller size dwelling, which is the majority. All right, real quick, last one.
Logical reasons for the humanoid form. We might find it easier to interact with something that looks like us, or more willing to trust it in our homes. But it's worth questioning whether the current humanoid fixation is driven by engineering logic or by the sci-fi imagery that shaped our expectations of what robots should look like.
Okay, we'll stop there. I'll put this up. Why domestic robots are closer than you think. I think the humanoid form is the obvious default for all of this. I don't think they're going to branch off into some other wheeled version or an arm with wheels running around the house. No. And the idea of a human form is, at some level, comforting to most people, I would think. Okay, that's it for this edition. But again, keep those seatbelts fastened because this is vaulting ahead at astonishing speed. Be right back.